The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode number 618. For Sunday, August 14th, 2016. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in, you send us whatever you want, and then we talk about it on the show. Hopefully it's about Apple products, but, you know, sometimes, actually often, we sort of venture outside that realm. The goal, of course, being for us all to learn at least four new things each and every time we get together. That's right. Longtime listeners will know that it used to be three. Now it's four because, you know, we got to raise the bar somehow here, and it's, frankly, a really easy way to do it. Our sponsor for this episode is Bushel at bushel.com/MGG mobile device management, and you can get three devices for free for life at that URL. We'll talk more about that later because it's a really, really cool thing. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How goes it, my good friend John F. Braun?
I'm just staying inside, man.
All right.
They basically are telling us don't go outside. It's bad.
Well, we've had a very forgiving summer here in New England thus far. So to have, you know, a weekend or a little more full of rain and crazy weather is something we're just going to need to accept. So it's all good. And plus, we got a podcast to do. When I'm in here in the studio, because I also use this room for band practice, I have these inserts that we built that we put in the windows. They're like insulation sandwiches of all sorts of things packed into a wood frame that just perfectly fits in the window. And so it blocks out not all sound, but quite a bit of sound and of course all light. So you could tell me that it was a bright shining sun outside or torrential downpour, and I would believe you either way, because I have no way of visually confirming or refuting that.
Right.
So let's go and do some quick tips, because that's what we're here for. Jacob says you'd been talking about some useful tips in one of your recent episodes with keyboard shortcuts and such. So I wanted to share a couple of useful things I found. Someone mentioned about using Command 1, Command 2, etc. to switch between Mail tabs and Safari tabs from the keyboard. A couple of the other things I found helpful are using the command and arrow keys, such as command and left, acts like a home button and moves the cursor to the beginning of the current line. Command and right moves the cursor to the end of the current line. Same type of idea, command up and command down, moving to the top or bottom of the document. This also works in Safari, where command down takes you to the bottom of the web page. I love using this on sites where there are links that I know are in the bottom of the page, like apple.com, where their refurb links and stuff are at the bottom there. And I don't want to have to scroll forever to get to them. Also, the same point, you can use option and down or up to act as a page up or page down. Lastly, when typing and doing this, you can use command delete to delete everything to the left of your cursor on the current line, or option delete to delete just the previous word. I find these really helpful when typing emails. I'm sure there are many more that I haven't discovered yet or I'm forgetting, but just wanted to share these. Wow, Jacob, you might have hit three of the four things we needed to learn in one fell swoop. Thank you, man. Very, very cool stuff. Anything on that one, John, or shall we keep moving on to listener John?
Moving on.
All right. Listener John writes somewhere. I'm going to find it. I swear. Uh-oh. Oh, I see where it is. Never mind. I thought. Yeah, right there. This is on a recent or perhaps not so recent Mac Geek Gab podcast. The Mac OS X split view was brought up. I think Dave's son might have explained one way to do it. I found a second way, which I think is much easier. My full screen applications are separate desktops. I also have mission control set up in my lower right hot corner. In mission control view, I have a banner at the top showing my desktops. Sometimes it's just a thin banner with a text label equal to the application name. If you place your cursor in the thin banner, the banner expands to show images of the desktop plus the text label. If I have two desktops and both are split view capable, you can drag one of the desktops in the banner and drag it over another desktop in the banner, and the Mac merges those two into split view. I don't think I heard this specific technique mentioned, so I wanted to share. That's very, very cool. I never realized that you could do that in the split view there, or in the browser bar, I guess is what we would call that in Mission Control. Very cool. Thank you, John. Good stuff. Moving on, John.
Moving on.
All right. Adam posted on Facebook in our Facebook group, which you can find at MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. That's the easiest way to get there. And it is growing leaps and bounds. So join the fun at any time. It would be great. Adam writes there. He says, recently, John and Dave described how you can access the desktop version of a website in Safari for iOS using the button in the share sheet. There is a sneakier and faster way. With the mobile version of the website open, hold the refresh button in the address bar and presto. I also get the option to load the site without content blockers, probably because I have one installed. I don't know if this option would show if the user did not have a content blocker. It does. I've tested it both ways. And you do, if you just hang on the refresh button on a mobile site, you will get the option to request the desktop version. So very, very cool, Adam. I love these quick tips, man. It's fun stuff. All right, Kevin, this one's more of a, it is a tip. Here's something that I stumbled upon, which I've not heard anyone mention previously. With any iOS device that has an A9 processor, which I believe is the 6S, the 6S Plus, and the iPhone SE, you can dictate without an internet connection. The accuracy appears to be just as good or as bad as anything before. Prior to the A9, an internet connection is required or was required to dictate. I'm curious as to why Apple hasn't seen fit to mention this, but I figured I would do it because I think it's wonderful. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, very, very cool. You're right. You can do dictation whether or not you are online. So, you know, and if you're on an airplane, you can dictate to your phone and please all of your seatmates. I think would be the best use case of that, don't you, John?
Why not?
Why not?
Let's see here. Yeah, I'm using the Mac Tracker. So, yeah, so the 6 is an Apple A8.
Right.
6S is the A9, is where the A9 starts.
And, and the iPhone SE also has the A9, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so the last three models that they list here are the A9.
Anything released 2015 and later, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's got the juice, yo.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this SE, by the way. I can't say enough good things about it. I didn't realize how much I missed having an iPhone of this size because I just immediately accepted when the 6 and 6 Plus came out that I had to go bigger in order to have the latest and greatest technology. And so I just accepted it and wound up going 6 Plus because if I'm going to go bigger, I might as well go biggest. And when I had the opportunity to try this thing out, man, I don't want to give it back, and I haven't. It's outstanding. I love this SE, so I'm kind of hoping.
Bigger isn't always better.
No, it's not. I really, like traveling in Europe, man, with this thing was fantastic. My family was jealous, especially my wife, who, she really enjoys the 6S Plus. When we were on like Segways and stuff, one-handed, I could take pictures and no problem with the SE. And she was like, yeah, I can't do that on the 6S Plus. I'm like, yeah, it's good. She does have a better camera on the 6S Plus, especially for low light stuff than the SE, but you know, it's all good. All right. Back to quick tips because we have quite a few of them left. Danny writes, my life is full of joy since I learned how to reduce the time it takes to see the dock popping to existence when the cursor hit the edge of the screen. And he gives us a terminal line, which is defaults write com.apple.doc auto hide time modifier int 0. And we will paste this into the show notes for today because that is handy, handy stuff. Very, very cool. So thank you for sharing that. Yeah, yeah, you can set that time down to zero. I have a feeling that Onyx might also let you adjust this in the GUI as opposed to having to go to the terminal. But either one's fine, and we can put those in the show notes. All right. And let's finish these up. Then we can talk about different business and stuff because we have a couple of deep dives that are coming up. And that reminds me of one because we're going to do one on the terminal. Although it's fair to say the first deep dive we did was the terminal. And I think it was like episodes 36 and 37. I don't know. It was early. I mean, like first year. But we definitely have done a deep dive on the terminal. But we'll revisit
it. Don't fear the terminal.
That's what we called it, I think. Seriously. Because the terminal's not the Reaper, nor does it have cowbell.
Right. But it scares a lot of people.
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
It's going back to a
And it should.
Time.
You should have a healthy respect for it. And well, I mean, you can really screw things up in the terminal.
Oh, you could destroy everything.
Yeah. But you'd have to really be intentional about that, though.
No,
right.
Not really.
No,
well,
that's true.
Most I would say most things that can do lots of damage, you usually have to do a pseudo before it.
Right. Right. Right.
So that's kind of the gate.
That's the gateway. Yeah,
if you exactly. don't know what to type after pseudo, then you probably shouldn't be
don't
doing
type
what
anything.
You're doing.
That's right. Yeah. No. Well, so we're gonna do a deep dive on the terminal, but we've got one coming up. Oh, we're here. We'll finish the quick tips in a second. Because we love our tangents on Mac Geek Gab, and you do too. The next one we're going to do is on backups, and I think it's going to be not next week, but the week after. So we've already actually got a ton of questions from you folks on backups, which is sort of what steered us towards this. But in addition to answering your questions in the deep dive episode, we'll kind of talk through our strategies and what we do and what we don't do and why we don't do it and all of that good stuff. But we'd love to hear from you. Your backup strategies really would be a great place to start. And if that triggers anything else, either out of you or if we read it in advance and prompt you for more, that would be great. And of course, your questions related to backup would be good too.
And your answer to our query better not be what backup?
Mm. Well,
otherwise we're going to come over and have words.
Yeah, that's right. And I know I'm going to have, well, that's the deep dive episode. It'll be like us coming over and having words. That's right. So feedback@macgeekgab.com is where you're going to send all of that stuff, folks. So make sure you,
no, sure you get that right. It's feedback@macgeekgab.com.
No, it's feedback@macgeekgab.com. That's where we're going to send all that stuff. All right. Finally, with our last couple of quick tips here before we get into regular tips, Chris writes and says, I have one handy little hint if any of your listeners use the inbuilt calculator on iOS. If you want to do a sum, say 9 times 9, that's not a sum, but anyway, I think I'm reading this right. 9 times 99. If you type 9 times 99, if you want to do 9 times 99, I'll get there, folks. This was a really small PDF. So if you intended to do 9 times 99, but accidentally did 9 times. Wow. You know, sometimes this job is harder than it looks. I'm just going to start right over at the beginning. So Chris, hang on. Let me reset the chapter marker here so that we get this right. And there we go. Chris sends in a tip for anybody that uses the calculator on iOS. If you want to, say, do 9 times 9, but accidentally type 9 times 99, just swipe to the left or the right on the number display window and the last input is deleted. Do it again for as many corrections as you need to make. It really saves time and frustration of pushing the C to clear the whole input. So we got that right the second time through. That's good. Fun stuff. Thank you for that. I had no idea that you could swipe to delete number by number. Very cool. And Jim with the final quick tip, and then we'll move on to some episode related follow-ups. Jim says, we have a music system downstairs and a separate system upstairs. Occasionally, I want to treat them as a single all-house system with the same music playing in sync. If you try to set this up using the AirPlay icon showing at the top of your screen in the menu bar, you will find it impossible. To make this work, you have to use the AirPlay icon at the top bar of the iTunes window. It drove me crazy till I figured it out. And you're right. Yeah, iTunes can do this and manage the syncing, whereas the system will not. So it might be obvious to those listening, and certainly would be obvious to Jim because he's tried it. But this, as a byproduct, does not mean that it will sync up all audio for the system. It's just iTunes that it's going to do this with. But it works. And it's if you haven't experienced, you know, whole home audio where you've got multiple speakers running in sync and being able to just kind of float around the house and hear the same music coming from everywhere, it's pretty special. And you know, Sonos is the one that has made that super easy for folks, but iTunes does it too. And if you've got all AirPlay speakers, then you're in good shape. Or really, actually, I guess it doesn't need to be AirPlay speakers. It's any speakers that are connected to your Mac, because they can be Bluetooth and that sort of thing too. So thank you, Jim. Good stuff. John, you want to take us into the follow-ups from last week? And I think that's all we have is follow-ups from last week.
Yeah, and this one was sent, because it was just a short little piece of information, but this was sent via Twitter. Well, we're talking about how to get in touch with us here. This was sent to our Twitter at MacGeekGab. But that's not the only Twitter you can use to reach us, Dave. There's also me, John Efron, you, Dave Hamilton, Pilot Pete, and Mac Observer, all Twitter addresses. And this one, you know, it's almost like we made a wish and somebody made this program, though they did it a while ago. I hadn't heard of this, but a tweet from John said, try photos-2-disk.com. And sure enough, if you go there, there's a program that will let you take stuff in Photos and export it in a way that's better than the way Photos does it. Because as we determined in a prior episode, although Photos can export, it doesn't do it in a very nice way. And then it pretty much is a flat file. And that's exactly what this program... I haven't tried this program. It looks like there's a trial and you can buy it. I'm going to assume that it's not like evil. I mean, I've never... You know, it says, you know, it's from Photo to Disk Inc. or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. I mean, it looks like somebody, you know, took it upon themselves. I mean, it looks like... When you look at it, it lets you surf the package and select things you want to export. But again, it looks to do it in a nicer way.
Yeah. Huh.
So thank you for that tweet.
Very cool. Nice find. I like it. Cool. All right. Bruce has, we were talking about iOS ghost apps in the last episode, and Bruce has a great tip. Sitting in MacGeekab 617, you had a listener comment about a ghost app that wouldn't delete and its data was sticking around. He says, I had this problem and was able to deal with it without a backup and restore in the following method. Number one, do a full iOS reboot. Then number two, re-download the app from the App Store. That will bring the app down and reattach it to the data that's there. Then do another full iOS reboot just for good measure, and then delete the app. Now that it's reattached to that data, when you delete the app, the data should be deleted as well. And Bruce says he's done this a couple of times, and it has worked brilliantly. That's the word I would use, brilliant. Very, very smart, Bruce. Thank you for sharing that and saving many folks the pain of having to restore from a backup just to get rid of that. So cool stuff. I like it. Now it's time to hear from JP. JP, take it away.
Hey, John. Hey, Dave. JP in LA. I'm just listening to the show. And your last question from the guy who wanted to have all of his files synced on his laptop and his desktop. And you were talking about personal cloud. I just wanted to share with you my personal cloud method. Cause I love it and I find it's been fantastic. I pay out the nose for Dropbox for the top of the line amount. And I literally use Dropbox as my folder storage for any documents that I need. And this includes videos. It also includes my music, my photos, because I do not use, I do not store the iTunes photos in the on the hard drive. I use, you know, I put it somewhere else. So I put everything in the Dropbox. I have, like, it's a filing cabinet for me. It's basically my documents folder. And it's fantastic. No matter where I go, no matter what I do and what computer I'm on, I open either one of them, and it's all sunk up, and everything is there. I find it quite delightful. And that's my method. I'm sure you guys do something similar, but thought I'd share that with you and your listeners.
Thank you very much, JP. Good stuff. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, that's how you have to pay for it. I mean, I guess the two things anybody might find wrong with it are that you have to pay for it and someone else has your data. But
he also says it's delightful, which
it is delightful.
That caught my attention.
Well, you know, that's the thing, though. I use a lot of different syncing things. I've used Dropbox. And when I talk about syncing things, I should clarify that. I've used a lot of different sync methods where you install an app on your Mac to manage this magical syncing in the background. And iCloud, iCloud Drive is one of those, right? Dropbox and iCloud Drive are by far the most reliable when it comes to just syncing your files without any weirdness. I also use BitTorrent Sync. I'm a huge fan of BitTorrent Sync. It's called Revelio or something like that. They changed it. It's at getsync.com. There's been some weirdness with that over the years. I mean, it's not insurmountable. I still use it. It's my main document sync engine. But sometimes there's files that just don't want to sync because, they have this character in the file name. It's like, you know what? If it's legal on the Mac, figure it out. That's that's what I've told them. They're like, well, there's a reason for that. It doesn't matter.
No,
it's irrelevant.
I don't care.
I don't care. Yeah, figure it out.
No, the thing is, you didn't design a good product. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, what they designed is a cross-platform product. But to be fair, so did Dropbox, and these same files sync with that. So back to the drawing board, figure it out. Right. And the same is true. Like Synology has their own thing, which of course requires a Synology unit to be used as a server or multiple ones if you want to spread it around. But they do have a Mac app and it's called CloudStation. And I used that for a while, but it had too many of those problems for me back then. It's actually gotten way, way better. And I've thought about moving away from BitTorrent Sync to that. But, you know, moving your sync engine, I guess it's not that difficult. You just kind of turn it off.
I like Dropbox.
Dropbox is good. Yeah.
Well, like I was saying, the bottom line is that you don't know it's there. And to me, that's a successful product it's not getting in your way, preventing you from doing things.
Right. Right.
Like you said, it's like, well, we got a good reason that we can't do this thing that you expect us to be able to do. And it's like, no, the reason is you screwed up.
The question is moot. That's it.
Yeah. You got to go back to the drawing board.
To the drawing board. Yeah. Yeah. So, And to be fair, they do go back to the drawing board and, you know, and then they'll fix, you know, these things, some of these things. And it's like, all right, cool. You know, and that's fine. I get it. You know, perhaps I'm too tolerant of that stuff at times because I understand what it's like to, you know, be a programmer and, design something and then there's this use case that you didn't predict. And so now you have to rethink it and it sucks, but that's kind of how it goes. So, all right. Also, last episode, we talked a lot about email archiving, and we have a couple of comments about that. First from Jim, he said, for my email archiving, I use a belt and suspenders approach. Two archiving programs. I use MailSteward Pro, set to run automatically early each morning, and another Email Archiver Pro, which I run manually from time to time. Both programs are able to archive email attachments. MailSteward Pro is a front end to MySQL and in my experience is something a bit problematic in that following heavy disk duty maintenance, like wiping caches using Onyx or Cocktail, then MailStorage Pro fails to find the database. It's a bit of a pain to reestablish the automated process following such glitches, so not recommended for non-geeks. Email Archiver Pro, he says, creates standalone PDF files of emails and attachments. So this may be very interesting to our listener from last episode. I have not experienced any glitches with this program. I've been using version 2, and there's now version 4, which touts an improved interface and more features. So many, it can run automatically now as well, perhaps. Beware, though, the base edition of version 4 supports only 5 email accounts. You have to pay more to have more accounts archived. So thank you very much, Jim, for the follow-up on that. This is, you know, it's a good conversation to be having. So, John, you got one, another one you found on Twitter.
Well, it's the same one, actually.
Oh, all right. There you go.
I'm just looking here, and I'm like, oh, email. Yes, so this was tweeted to us by listener John, basically saying, yep, Email Archiver Pro.
Sweet.
So we got 2 votes for that.
2 votes. Yeah. I love it.
MySQL, that's a good database.
They bake it into to MailStorage. Yeah. MySQL's great. It's I mean, there's a built-in one. I guess MySQL is built into OS X as well, right? I think. I know. SQLite is, but I feel like MySQL is too. I could be wrong on that. I mean, I have it on most of my OS X machines. I just can't remember which ones I put it on manually with like Brew or something. So we'll talk more about that in the terminal episode. All right. Pete goes back 1 episode prior to share some thoughts about CPUs.
Hi, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. This is Pete from Wisconsin. In response to the temperature and overheating questions from MGG616, while it's true that he is operating within specs on the processor, it has always been true of electronic devices that when you operate near the extremes of any specified value, whether it be temperature, voltage, current, radiation level, magnetic field strength, stuff like that, operating near those extremes can cause, it can significantly shorten the lifespan of the product. So with CPUs generally outlasting the computers that they're mounted in nowadays, I don't know if Pete will ever see, you know, ever see the result of that, but just something to bear in mind. Might not be a bad idea once in a while to take control of the fan and set it to highest RPM just to get some added airflow. Hope this helps with any questions people may have, and it's just yet another way to keep from getting caught.
Thanks very much, Pete. Good stuff. You're right. Yeah.
He kills.
Yeah. It kills electronics, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and you know, don't leave your kids or pets in the car in the summer either.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, there's that. I mean, cold kills too, you know.
Yeah, well, any extreme.
That's kind of what it, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But cold doesn't kill electronics.
But, you know, I've heard the same argument used for batteries and charging and stuff. People are like, well, you know, it generates heat and that hurts the battery. I think it does.
Yeah.
The more heat you generate, the
yeah.
Well, things use more power or, so yeah, I'm with that. Though at least, you know, in the case of the Intel processors we spoke, they have the one level and then they have the, oh, okay, I'm going to turn off because I'm about to break.
Right, right.
I think it was 100 degrees and then 130 degrees is where it says, no, something's not right.
Yep. All right. We have a couple of questions about notes. One is really kind of a follow-up from a previous episode in that Paul asked, I heard you mention a notebook software that Dave and John shared, use to share show notes and agendas together. I'm wondering what you used. I used Notebook from CircusPonies.com until they went out of business. I'm always on the lookout for alternatives. I enjoy your podcast. Okay. Yeah. So for notes, John and I are using Evernote to share our notes and then Google Docs here and there. We use Google Docs when we're doing the show live. So our timestamps, which we put into our agenda, we have a Google Doc that we use every week. And then we also have our show notes in a Google Doc that we build as we do the show every week, and then John goes back through and kind of flushes those out. And it's not actually the Google Docs are not just us. It's anyone in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream that can join us there and really help edit those notes. And many of you do. And thank you for that. It makes life a whole lot easier. So, yeah, we use Evernote. I have recently re-begun experimenting with notes on iCloud, and the iOS 10 version of notes, and really actually even the iOS 9 version, is really quite full featured. In fact, I'm doing these gigs with many of you may remember Paul Kent, who used to run Macworld Expo, and he was in charge of the conferences for a long time, and then took over the entire expo, and he's got a band out in California, and I'm going to fill in with him because his drummer's out. And I needed to build some charts. But, the charts that I need to build are not just straightforward sheet music. I need occasionally to sort of scribble in some rhythms or whatever. But for the most part, I just need to write, the form of a song, something to remind me about, we do the chorus twice here and then we stop on the three and this, that, and the other thing. But I need something. I've always just used a pad of paper because I can scratch like little figures, rhythmic figures in notation that make sense to me, and also write words. And I had yet to really find a note taking program that lets me do both. And Apple Notes is actually working pretty well. I'd be happy to hear some advice for other things, but Apple Notes, very, very good. And the reason, John, that you and I switched to Evernote as opposed to as opposed to Apple Notes for the show is because at the time Apple Notes did not allow us to have a notebook shared between the two of us. We can sync our personal notebooks to all of our devices, and that just sort of works automatically with iCloud, but we can't share
a notebook. Their multimedia support was non-existent,
right?
Until
and we put like the audio comments. We're actually playing them right out of Evernote. So we put your audio comments right into an Evernote notebook that John and I can both see, and then I just go into Evernote and hit play, and that works really, really well. So yeah, Evernote works for us, but the Notes app may work very, very well for you, and I would not discount it. So there you go. That's my thought. Although, I had somebody write us this morning saying that they recently moved from Evernote to Microsoft's OneNote, and people are ecstatic with how great OneNote is. Totally cross-platform. Obviously, it runs on Windows, but there's a Mac app. There's iOS apps, cloud syncing, sharing, much easier. The user interface of OneNote is, from what we're told, much easier than Evernote to deal with things like lists and checkboxes and all that good stuff. So I highly recommend checking it out. I've checked it out, but it's been a while. But if Evernote gets weird on us, I would say we would look at Notes first, because you and I are both, diehard Apple enough that the lack of a Windows client isn't really going to hurt us.
But OneNote.
People like it. Yeah, it's Microsoft. That's right. Yes, that's right.
Oh, they're not evil anymore.
No, they're not. No. they kind of know what they're doing over there in some ways. Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And then Bobby, in the notes realm, we may have already answered Bobby's question in a way, but Bobby has a couple, so we'll go through it. He says, in the iOS Notes app, you can get a count of how many notes you actually have per account. For example, on my iPhone in the Notes app, I can easily see that I have 57 notes in iCloud. Is it possible to get the count on my laptop running El Capitan? I can see the notes, but can't see the number to confirm that it's the same on my iPhone. And then number two, his question is, do you know how to copy or move notes from one Apple ID account to another? And the answer for both of those is yes, Bobby, I've got you covered. So for number one, I would have sworn that at some point in time, I could scroll to the bottom of the list of notes and see the count. And maybe that's true on iOS. Maybe that's where that's coming from. But if you do that on El Capitan in the Notes app, you don't get to see it. However, If you select all of your notes, they will highlight, and then grab them with the mouse and just move ever so slightly. You don't want to actually move them. Just start to move them, and you will see a little paper icon, like a stack of paper icon that shows that you're moving notes, and a red number attached to it. And the red number is the number of notes you have selected. So if you've selected all, you now have a count of your notes. So when there's a Will or a Dave, there's a way. So there you go. That's number one. Number two, yeah, you can move notes, but you can copy notes, or I suppose you can, and you can move them too between iCloud accounts. The way you would do this is to add a second iCloud account to your Mac. And this sounds weird, but it's actually quite elegant because Apple knows that you might have a reason to have multiple iCloud accounts. You might have different calendars in one. You might have different contacts in one. You might have different mail. And that's a very valid reason to want to have two iCloud accounts. But it's also smart enough to know that when you add the second iCloud account, to not treat it the same way that your primary iCloud account is. So you don't get Back to My Mac. You don't get, Find My iPhone. You don't get any of that stuff on the secondary or tertiary iCloud accounts. What you get is Safari syncing. What you don't get is Safari syncing, photo syncing, document syncing, Keychain, Back to My Mac, or Find My Mac. What you do get is mail, contacts, calendars, reminders, and notes. So you can attach a second iCloud account, and in the iCloud pref pane, this is where you're doing it, you would only check the notes box if you don't want it to start pulling mail and contacts and calendars and reminders. And then you'll just see it appear in notes in the app, and you can move stuff back and forth very, very easily. And then once it's there, you can sign out of the account and you're totally fine. So that's how I recommend doing it. Good stuff, right, John?
Okay.
Do you have another way?
Well, you could always share your notes, but that's kind of primitive.
Yeah.
No, with a little share box, there's a lot of options there. But
But you're not.
No, I get it. But
you're not sharing the entire notebook, right? That would be the problem.
Exactly.
You'd have to share them individually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy making. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about our sponsor for this episode, John, if that works for you.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Our sponsor for today is Bushel at bushel.com/MGG. And that's where you go to sign up for your free for life Bushel account that gets you three devices for free forever of Bushel's awesome mobile device management solution. What does that mean? You can control and configure iPhones, iPads, and even Macs remotely. So obviously, if you're working somewhere and you need to do that, this makes perfect sense. You don't have to pull all the devices into your office to do it. Where it gets even more valuable is if you were a consultant and you've got lots of clients everywhere. Maybe you've got some of them on a maintenance plan and they can just call you and you do whatever you need. Well, this is perfect for that. This way, you can make sure things are set up just right. You can fix an email password. You can tweak whatever it is you need to tweak in the settings remotely with the client's permission, of course. Three devices for free for life. And after that, it's just $2 per device per month. So if you've got a client on a maintenance plan, this $2 pays for itself right away. You've got to check this out. Go to bushel.com/MGG, sign up for your account, and see how easy their interface is. It's all wrapped up into one web interface. You can manage those Apple devices when you want, wherever you want, and Bushel makes the complex simple so that you can focus on your customers. You got to check it out. Bushel.com/MGG. Our thanks to Bushel for sponsoring this episode.
And now, Dave.
Yes.
Let's go to Darren Christopher.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. Take it away.
He's got like a double first name. That's kind of cool.
That's cool.
Or it's a typo. I don't know. All right, so Darren Christopher writes in and says, I'm a huge fan. Yeah, and we're a huge fan too. What's his problem? Here's his problem. We're going to figure it out, I think. Or at least I think I figured it out. I recently have been trying to figure out if there's a way to see the size of a directory when using Terminal in the recovery environment so I can know how much space I may need when trying to pull data from a volume on a Mac to an external device. On occasion, I have to back up data from the terminal in the recovery environment due to damage, and I can't get booted into the system but can see files with the recovery. So, the question is, do you know of any way where I can tell the size of a directory? Yes.
From the terminal.
Correct. So, the terminal, as we spoke. The terminal from within recovery. Now, here's the problem, Dave. So, if you're in recovery, which is Apple's little mini environment where you can do certain things, and you get to it by holding down Command and R when you boot your machine, one of the things you can do is go into terminal. Now, the question being presented is, how do I see the size of a directory? And I think there was a suggestion. Well, I know about ls, and I think we all know about ls. But if you don't, ls is the command that you type in the terminal that lets you see files in a directory. But it's not, and it shows the size, too, depending on what switch you use, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Here's the problem, though. It's terrible for telling you the size of a directory because it doesn't, Dave. Did you know that? I was looking for a way to get ls to tell me the size of a directory. I mean, it'll show you when you do an ls, you'll see a d, which indicates that something is a directory.
Yeah, but it'll show you the size of it'll show you the number of bytes that the actual file entry for the directory takes. Right. But that's not the contents of the directory, which is really what you want to know.
That's not what we want.
Right, right.
The problem is, now, you know, there may be a better command to do that, Dave. And I think there is. And actually, I found a little mojo here that you can do from the terminal that'll show you the size of all the directories nicely listed in the current directory that you're in. So, you know, that's the first thing. So you got to get to it. But then here's the problem, Dave. So, as I mentioned, recovery is kind of like a little baby OS X environment. Well, it doesn't have some commands like these commands I'm going to tell you to use. So first off, I'm going to tell you the command. So step one, here's what you want to use instead. There's something called du. Now that's what you want to use, because du, the purpose of that command is to list disk usage statistics. And that includes, by the way, how big a directory is. So the command is, I found this and tweaked a little bit. No, I don't think I tweaked it. Maybe a little bit. But du is the command. Space dash dash s h. All right. H is human readable. S is show an entry for.
So, yeah, it's a single entry for each file. Because otherwise, du will just pull the entire whatever you tell it to look at. It will add it all up as right. One. And so if you want individual directories, you want the S. That's right.
And then a space, then a star, which means everything, then a space, then a vertical bar. What does that mean? Well, that means, okay, well, feed what I'm going to say to what's coming up next. Basically, then this is what makes it look pretty. Then you do a space, then say sort, then space, then dash R. And once you do that, well, we're not quite there yet, because as I mentioned, du and sort aren't in the path of or aren't available to you from recovery. So what you have to do is type in the path to a disk that has it, like probably the disk that you're connected to. So in my case, or actually in every case, so you would type slash volumes slash the name of the disk that has this command in it, slash usr slash bin slash
I'm going to have MGG Jim write this up so that, because there's no way anybody's going to understand what you're saying. I mean, I think if they already understand the concept, they're already there. If they don't, they're not going to get there with an audio audible.
Well, in the show notes, I'm going to paste this.
But, okay, cool. Yeah,
but the concept is you have to explicitly type in the path of where these commands are, because they're not available to you via the path that recovery sets. Or sure. I suppose you could set the path, but I think this is easier. It's probably about the same amount of typing. So that is the answer.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
I do.
Path equals, and then do some magic there. By the time you're done with that, you could just type it in manually. You could just type in the entire path.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's the answer. That had to scratch my head a bit on that one. Because at first I didn't know. I'm like, can you use LS? And it's like, no, LS, it's not meant to do this thing.
Yeah, it's not meant to do it. That's right. Yeah.
All right.
That's pretty cool. I don't know that I would include sort in that. Only because it adds confusion to it. You know, I would just.
Yeah, you don't have to put it there.
Uh-uh.
Yeah. And the thing is, it will take a little while because it's doing quite a bit of work on the disk. So don't be surprised if when you type this in, it doesn't immediately respond. All right.
Yeah. All right. What's next? Okay. We'll go to, man, I got like frog in my throat. Allergies. Fun stuff. We'll go to Alan here. And Alan has actually another great one that I think will turn into an article here. Alan says, I have an iTunes library of 6,500 items. iTunes Match is turned on and I run on a 2012 MacBook Air. But it's limited in space. So a long time ago, I moved my iTunes library to an external drive. At first, it was a portable USB drive, but I got tired of lugging around a second piece of hardware. So I bought an SD card that was large enough and moved the library there. I thought I had a backup of the SD card, but when the SD card failed to mount yesterday, I searched and found no backup. I want to set up a new library on an external drive and download all my music from iTunes Match. So in theory, in a sense, there was a backup. But I cannot figure out how to do that. I can see the music and access it on my iPhone and iPad, but neither has room for more than a fraction of my library, so I can't download the entire library there. In iTunes on the Mac, all my music shows up, but if I try to play anything, it doesn't download because it thinks it's on the SD card that's not there and reports that the original item cannot be found and asks me to locate it. But I no longer have my copy. So how can I make the Mac download from the cloud? Ideally, I'd want it to download everything. But if I have to select chunks to download, that's fine. All right. This is a great question. And you're totally right that the reason that iTunes is complaining is because it thinks that the file is already downloaded. That's the problem, is your iTunes library, quote unquote, knows that it already has the file downloaded and it just can't find the local copy. And it's asking you to locate that. The trick is getting iTunes to realize you ain't never going to give it the local copy because it's gone. One way would be to start a brand new iTunes library, launch iTunes with the option key down, create a new library, log into your Apple ID that has iTunes Match enabled, and then you'll see all these files and it'll be kind of the same thing that you get on your iPhone. And you can just select all and right click and tell it to download, and then it'll slurp them all down from the cloud. Or you could try telling your current iTunes library to delete the local copy. I can't test this here because I'm not experiencing the same problem that you are. But if I click on a song in my iTunes library, I can say delete. And then when if I right click on it, I mean, I can choose delete, or you can do it from the file menu. And then it'll ask you, do you want to delete just your copy or also delete from iCloud? Do not choose to delete from iCloud. Hopefully that's obvious, but I'll say it anyway. And then once you do that, then you might be able to trigger it to download it again. And of course, you can do this with multiple songs by just doing a select all or multiple selections. Before you do that, though, and in either case, whether you create a new library or you go to pull this one down, you'll want to, because you don't have enough room on your internal drive for all of these songs, you will want to point your iTunes library to save its media in a place where you do have this storage. So maybe you've got another SD card that you're going to back up from now forward, or you have an external USB drive that you're going to back up from now forward. And so, point it there first, and you do that by going into iTunes Preferences Advanced and set your iTunes media folder location. And then you can download all this stuff. But if you start downloading it before that, it's just going to put it on your hard drive or your boot drive because it can't find it anywhere else. So just bear that in mind. But I think you'll be all right. I think you're going to I think iTunes Match is going to save your bacon on this one, Alan, which is a beautiful thing, or at least most of your bacon. There might be a couple of things that couldn't upload to iTunes Match because they were the wrong file type or too large, too long, I guess, is the real trick. But for the most part, I think you're going to get your stuff back, which is good news. Thoughts on this, John?
Bacon.
Bacon. Yep, that's right. All right. Listener Greg has he's an interesting question. I'm actually looking forward to this discussion. So, Greg writes, I'm going to a client today, and she always asks me to import her new photos. Her operating system is Mountain Lion, and her iPhone is an iPhone 6 Plus on iOS 8 still. The reason for not upgrading is I think there's an issue with her iPhone. I'm also waiting for her to get a new computer, which she says she's going to buy a new one soon, and I didn't want to update it as it's real old with an old hard drive. She's been saving this for almost a year. Her old iMac is a 2009. She has current backups as I set up Time Machine. The main issue this gets really confusing. We'll talk about one of the problems with it, and then we'll talk about the main issue. He says, I've noticed that when trying to import her voice memos, she has a ton of them from over the years from the Memos app. Some of them cannot transfer to the Mac, and I have to use iMazing to go to the root of the phone and find the raw file to export and then rename it. Many times when using iMazing, when I click the copy to Mac button for that individual voice memo, I get an error saying that it can't be found. This happens probably 10% of the time. Going into the view where I can see all the folders, I can find the file by date, and I can successfully extract it using iMazing. I have a feeling that maybe the directory on her iPhone is corrupted for the voice memos or something. I don't know if there's a limit or for how many voice memos you can have. I told her that we need to erase her phone and restore it, but I couldn't promise that her voice memos will come back to the voice memos app because there's this corruption. I also told her we would have to use iTunes to store her voice memos. That's because I'm going to be doing a nuke and pave and not a restore. She's not ready to do that yet, so I haven't erased the phone. The main issue is a couple of weeks ago, I connected her iPhone to the computer and I launched Image Capture, Aperture, and iPhoto, and none of them were able to see her new photos. I can see photos up to a certain date, but it didn't show her the new photos in the import window. I think she has 10,000 photos on her phone and she's not using iCloud Photo Library. I'm connecting through a Lightning cable. A couple of weeks ago, I could see the new photos and they did import, but it's an intermittent problem. And some weeks I can see it and some weeks I can't. I know that I should do a nuke and pave on the iPhone, but she's not ready to do that yet. So I'm not sure what to do or what to tell the client. Yes, she's high maintenance, but that's kind of the client. That's the kind of client she is. And that's okay. Now, she's very scared that she's going to lose her files. So that's the main reason why she doesn't want to change anything or do the nuke and pave. Do you have any advice? So, yeah, I have a lot of advice on this because I've done this before. So your best bet is to keep shooting backups with iTunes and or iMazing and preserve that data as long as possible. I mean, when things do finally fall apart for reals, having those backups is going to help a lot. But the reality is, and I know you know this, the phone needs to be upgraded at the very least, or wiped and upgraded, and probably wiped and upgraded because it sounds like everything you're describing sounds like directory corruption of some sort. But I think the bigger problem is not the phone, it's the customer. When I was doing a lot of on-site consulting, I dealt with folks like this. And this, you know, like when I started doing it back in the 90s, people were even more fearful of technology than they are now in general, although your client certainly, you know, is approaching an extreme. A couple of years ago, we came up with a term on this show, and I can't exactly remember why. But the term was RatGawk, and our goal on this show is for us to be your RatGawk. What is that? Your reasonable and trusted geeks of choice. And that starts with reasonable. So you have to suggest things that make sense. And then it moves on to trusted, and you have to suggest things that are in your client's best interest, not yours. When we were running Computer Nerds in Austin back in the 90s, this happened all the time. I'd hire a new nerd and they'd go out in the field and then I'd check in with their customer or whatever. And I'd hear that, oh, yeah, you know, Timmy came out. We never had a nerd named Timmy. Timmy came out and you fixed my printer that I called you for and then installed all kinds of stuff on my computer that he said would make it run better. But now I can't find how to get to my clock because he installed this custom clock that he said he liked better. It was something. It would be something like that. And so I'd sit Timmy down and I'd say, Timmy, you like that custom clock thing, don't you? Oh, yeah, it's awesome. It's the best. Totally great. Awesome. Make sure you install that on all of your computers. Good. Right. Well, one more thing, Timmy. Don't ever install it for a client again. Why? Because the client didn't ask you for that. You need to stop and you can make recommendations to the client. But for the most part, and we're about to put an asterisk on that, for the most part, you then have to just, you know, here's my recommendation and then ask, what would you like me to do? And if the client's like, I like my clock the way it's all good, then it's all good. And thank you very much. And on your way. Right. So generally, trust comes from doing what the customer wants and nothing more. But sometimes, and in this case, you have to build up enough of that trust so that you can leverage it and tell the client the right thing to do, even though that might come with a little bit of pain. The data that exists for her in iMazing or iTunes is always going to be there, right? I mean, if you're able to back it up with iMazing and see that data, then you can save that data elsewhere. But her phone is only going to get worse at this point. And she needs to buy into this, of course. But you really need to work on her in this regard is my thought, as opposed to anything else. I mean, you're patching a dying situation here. And you got to, it sounds like she's been kind of on this real soon now, going to upgrade path. And I think you need to kind of nudge her along one way or another. The customer, you know, there's the customer service angle of this. And that's such an important part. I know we have a lot of folks that listen to the show that are consultants. And it's easy, right? I mean, I err on the side of customer service. Whatever the client wants, I will do. Except when I know that it's the wrong thing for them. But then I just sit them down and, you know, we turn away from the computer and talk just as humans to each other about, look, if this were my computer, here's what I would do. And if we don't do anything, here's where we're going to get. And I think it's really important. You know, the problem is, of course, that Apple won't let you install iOS 8 back on this phone. So she's going to have to move to iOS 9, right? When you wipe this thing, it's going to upgrade. There's a lot of good things about upgrading. You'd be able to run apps. But, you know, there's also this whole security side of being up to date and all of that. So I think on this one, you know, the tech solution, the thing is working on the client. Thoughts, John?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, no, I was just saying, I agree. Yeah. What you said, but, if there's any nugget here, it's clear that the state of the phone is getting worse and you have to deal with it somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, a 2009 iMac will probably...
Tough love. We need tough love here.
We'll run El Capitan just fine. I don't know. I think you could upgrade both, but certainly the phone needs to go up. Or it needs to be wiped, and because of that, needs to be upgraded because of the way Apple does things. So, and I get it. I get there's the fear of nuking and paving the phone. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only reason we're comfortable with it here is because... A, we talk about it all the time because B, we've had to do it enough to know where those pain points are going to be. Like, I know if I got to reboot my phone, invariably, I'm going to have to reconnect to a wireless network and type in a mail password here or there. I mean, in theory, it's all saved in my backups, but there's going to be something where it's like, oh, yeah, I got to re-download the data for that app. The map data for, you know, this didn't stick in the backup. Okay, fine. You know, and there is. There's that kind of stuff that you're not going to remember what all of it's going to be. But, you know, with iCloud and the way everything sort of exists in the cloud these days, you don't lose as much as you used to. You know, it's not all that difficult. So anyway, that's my thoughts. John, I upgraded my computer, actually both of them. This week, or both of the computers in the office, both the 27-inch iMacs. I have my 2011 iMac here in the studio, and yeah. then a 27-inch. This is a 27-inch 2011 and then a 27-inch Retina from 2014 yeah. downstairs. I put new RAM in. So I went from...
How much did you have?
I had 12 here in the studio and 16 in the office. And I
12? Oh, 8 and 4. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly. Weird. Yep. And I upgraded both of them. I got some Crucial RAM, and I upgraded them both to 32 gigs. Hunted around for prices. Crucial was far and away the best. So
who needs that much memory?
You know, here's the interesting thing. It was relatively inexpensive, so it was like, all right, yeah, I can, you know, fine, I can do this. And then I was actually ready to pull the trigger, and the folks at Crucial always yell at me whenever I do that. So I told them, I said, fine, I'm about to pull the trigger, but you yell at me whenever you hear that I've bought RAM. And so they sent it to me for free, but I was going to buy it from them because they, like I said, they had the best prices. But full disclosure here. So it wasn't that expensive to begin with. When I would start my machine in the office, so the one with 16 gigs of RAM, and launch the apps that I typically use during the day, it would be using somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 gigs used and 2 gigs free. So no swap being used or anything like that. I did exactly that after I put this 32 in, and I was at 17 gigs used and the rest free.
So there's a delta of 3. Why is that?
My guess is that there were things that wanted to be in RAM that weren't. And this is like active RAM as reported by iStat menus, not inactive, which is sort of like cache, if you will. So it invariably over time, as it's booted, as it's longer and longer since it's booted, you're going to have stuff just pile up in inactive RAM, which is fine because it might as well be used. But this is like it's using more active RAM than it was previously. So I can only assume that, you know, some of OS X's memory management, perhaps memory compression, was being used on stuff that wanted to be in active RAM, but just couldn't be because there wasn't enough active RAM. But it wasn't so much that it needed to page out to disk. That's the only I'm guessing here. But, you know, based on what I understand, that's the only thing that makes sense to me. I'm wide open. Any thoughts on what would cause? I certainly feel like I feel justified in upgrading the RAM. It's like, well, if it needed more, that's great. But I'm curious what you think, John.
I don't have such ridiculous amounts of RAM. So.
No, I'm not talking about your situation. I'm talking about your thoughts.
I'd have to study. I'd have to do some study to the.
So, well, here we are. I'm doing the show, right? I don't have anything launched that I would not have otherwise. I have the same things launched this week that I would have last week. I rebooted the machine yesterday, so because I put the RAM in, and we'll talk about that actually in a second. But so it's not like, you know, it's had a zillion things running or anything. And right now on this machine, actively used, not inactive, but actively used RAM is at 14 and a half gigs. So that's more RAM than I had before. And again, on this machine, I would not have had any page outs at this point, no swap used. So I can only assume that it was previously using memory compression and now is not, or doesn't have to. But
if as you, much.
Well, at all. I mean, I've got 13 gigs free right now on this machine. So I'm guessing it doesn't need to do any memory compression at the moment. Right.
Yeah. Well, of course, you can tell by going to activity monitor and then memory and looking at the compressed memory column.
744K.
Hey, look at that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. It's interesting.
All I can say is you can never have too much RAM, right?
What does that mean? So.
Well, and then you can have too little RAM.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
But you can never have too much, can you?
Not anymore, no. I think there was a time. I mean, well, that machines, no, you can't have too much. You can't. I mean, there were some machines over the years where, like, you couldn't, if you put too much in, it would crater the machine. But well, that was like a motherboard issue, not not an OS issue. Yeah.
Right.
So, on the, I was reminded of a fun story, but on this iMac in the studio here, it's the 2011 and the RAM door is on the bottom. So, you know, you just tilt the thing forward and unscrew three screws and then, you know, pop chips in or out as you see fit, always with the computer off. Or at least it should be. On the iMac in the studio or in the office, the Retina iMac, which is newer than this one, there's a RAM door on the back of it, right above the power cord in, you know, where you plug power in. And there's no screws, though. There is a push button release to pop the door open. And that push button is obscured by the power cable. So nice. You cannot push the button with the power cable in. So you have to really be intentional about popping RAM in and out with this computer on, because you'd have to like pop the door open you'd have to pull power out, pop the door open, and then plug power back in and turn it back on if you really wanted to do this. But it's a cool little thing. It's got like a little lever, and the entire RAM assembly, like chassis, sort of swings out and you plug RAM in. But it's good to keep people from doing the wrong thing, which is plugging stuff in to the motherboard of a running computer. When I was fixing Windows machines in 1995, maybe 96 at this point, you know, prior to that, there was no plug and play, right? So you couldn't just plug something into the computer and have it work. You had to set what IRQ, what interrupt it was going to be on, what memory address it was going to be addressable at, and all of that stuff. And so you had to look in the whatever it was, and it wasn't the device manager, but you had to look and figure out what was open and then use jumpers on the cards to set things or whatever. And that was true no matter what kind of card you were plugging in. So and then Windows 95 introduced plug and play, where essentially the hardware was built to talk to the operating system when it was plugged in. And it would come up with, you know, where it could live, and then the OS would tell it and it would move it automatically. So it was great. You just get something, you plug the card in. So so I was doing that for this woman, and we were sitting at her computer, and we kind of looked and just made sure everything looked good in Windows. And you know, and then I had to, like, she had a tower, because that's the only kind of computer that existed back then if you didn't have a laptop. And it was, you know, a Windows machine, but it was running 95. And so I went around the back and I unscrewed the case and, you know, pulled the case off and all of this stuff, and unscrewed the slot cover and plugged the new US Robotics plug and play modem in. And I hear the customer say, of course, I'm not looking at the screen at this point. You know, she's on the other side of the desk. I'm like, you know, digging around at the computer. And I hear her say, "New hardware found." As soon as I plug the card in, I hear her say this. And then I realize the computer is running. And so she says, "Wow, I didn't know you could do that with the computer on." And my response was, "Well, you know, not everything can be done that way, but with this one, it works, you know, and it's fine." Yeah, that was almost an expensive day for Dave, but it worked out just fine. But yeah, don't repeat that mistake. Don't plug anything into your computer with the
You know, why shouldn't you be able to plug and unplug things with the power on? I mean, you could do it with hard drives. Why can't you do it with other stuff?
Yeah, I know. So that actually
wasn't always the case with hard drives, but most hard drives these days are hot swap. Well,
yeah.
At least the ones in a NAS.
Right. Well, that's the thing is, yeah. And evidently this motherboard was totally fine with, you know, this thing just magically appearing. The problem would be is if I, you know, didn't put it in at the right angle and shorted one pin, you know, I mean, that would have been the big issue. I mean, I never did that again, but.
I think I did that once too. And I used to tell about it.
Yeah. But it was like when she said, "New hardware found." Ooh. It was like, you know, my blood pressure shot up, and it was like, all right, game face, you know. It's all good. No harm, no foul. It was good. But anyway, so I'm happy to be at 32 gigs of RAM on these machines. And it seems like I needed it. I mean, I'm now using, you know, almost 20 gigs on this one. So, I mean, you know, I'm running Safari and it's using 9 gigs of RAM with like 3 tabs open. So, you know, Safari's got some memory leaks.
Yeah, well, so Safari leaks memory like a sieve. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly. So really, why did I need more memory? Safari. That's the answer, folks. How could I need this much? I mean, I literally have 4 tabs open. Do I have some window open with, like, you know, load up, fill up the ram.com on it or something? No, nothing. I don't get it. Anyway, so there you go. It, it just, you know, I didn't really think I needed more RAM in my machines, but decided that I should do it because the prices were right. And as it turns out, I might have. So there you go. If anybody has any ideas on that, let us know. You want to talk to us about Joe, John?
Yeah, Joe's got a weird one. I think. I'm not sure what to think about this. And the title of it is Recovery Partition Missing in OS X El Capitan, but I don't think it really is. But Joe says, I noticed recently that booting with Option Active no longer presented my recovery partition on my MacBook Air. Interestingly, my iMac at home, however, did, with both running the latest version of El Capitan. It bugged me. In doing some research, I found a new, I guess new to Joe, command that actually booted directly into the recovery partition, which I had never heard mentioned on the show before. I tried it, and sure enough, the recovery partition is there and intact, so I'm not sure if El Capitan did something different or if I have an issue with the MacBook Air, but at least I know how to start it. I thought it'd be worth mentioning. All right, so the feedback for Joe. So Joe, hats off to you, man, because what Joe was doing was a non-standard way of getting into recovery. Right?
Yeah.
And that he was actually activating what is known as the startup manager. And what is that, you may ask? And I'm going to tell you. Well, the startup manager is what you see when you boot and you hold down the alt key or the option key. Same thing.
Yeah.
So number one, you found a cool feature, and this is a feature that some people may need to use if you want to see a list of all the potential devices that your computer can boot from. When you're troubleshooting, you may need to do that. So that's a cool thing. But then I was like, well, you know, that's kind of weird because one of my machines, is that I recall the last time I ran the startup manager, one of my machines, I saw the recovery partition and the other one, I didn't. I'm like, why is that? And you know, I don't know if I quite have the answer yet, Dave.
Yeah.
Because I tried it on one machine and I didn't see a, you know, it'll be named something like recovery dash 11 dot whatever dot whatever. And on one machine, I saw it and the other, I didn't. I'm like, why is that? And then I looked at the two machines and I thought I had the answer, but now I don't think I do, Dave, is that one machine had File Vault on and the other does not.
Mm.
Like, huh, well, that's kind of weird. Well, you know what? Let me turn on File Vault on the machine that is showing. And I thought it was on this on my Mini, but it wasn't. I'm like, well, let me turn on File Vault and see if recovery still appears in the startup manager. And sure enough, it didn't. And I'm like, oh, well, I must have answered the question. So I asked them, well, do you have File Vault on one of these and not on the other? And he's like, no. But what he did show me was a list of his disks. So I think I have an answer to this. So the main point here is that there are two features you can take. So the thing that he found that he considers new is actually the correct way to get into recovery, which, as we mentioned, he said, he doesn't recall us talking about this. I'm almost certain we've talked about it, Dave, but we're going to talk about it again. But yeah, holding down Command R is the proper way to get into recovery. Yeah, it had me scratching my head because the thing is, what he's seeing is not consistent with what I'm seeing, Dave, and that neither of my machines now will I see recovery if I go in the startup manager.
Because you have to, because you have to decrypt first. Is that right?
No, I don't know.
Huh.
I think what it could be, though, because then he gave me a list that you'll get. So if you go to the Apple menu about this Mac and then you click on System Report, the thing is you will see a different view of your disk. Typically, what I click on is SATA Express because that's what I have in this one machine.
Sure.
If you click on that, you're then going to see your drive, but then what you'll see at the bottom of the list is you'll see the different volumes. And for example, what I see on mine is EFI disk 0S2, which is the main drive, and then recovery HD. So that's where you look to see the different partitions. There's another place you can look that gives you a different view, Dave, and I think this is what he was describing to me. If you go to storage, That's also in the hardware category. You'll see a different thing, and he then read off something, and it indicated a logical volume group.
Oh, that's File Vault. That's whole disk encryption, for sure.
But I think is that you may also... So the thing I think is once something is under the category of a logical volume group, and this is not the only time I've seen this, Dave, that you will also see a logical volume group if you have a Fusion drive. So logical volume group is basically the file system is doing something clever, and I think the two clever things that the Apple file system will do that engages a logical volume. So I don't think you'll see a logical volume group with just a regularly formatted drive, but you will see it if it's either encrypted or if it's a Fusion drive.
Wondering, no, you're totally right. Yeah.
I'm wondering if that, because I don't have a Fusion drive, so I'm wondering if that may be the reason that he's not seeing recovery. So if anybody has any additional information on that, so what we learned here in a kind of roundabout way, what we just offered here is how you should be able to get into recovery on any machine.
Right. Right.
He was getting into it kind of by accident, which is kind of cool, but
yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Huh? Your guess is as good as mine.
And it caused me to review my system settings and realize I didn't have File Vault on my Mini, which I should have.
Yep.
So I think everybody should have File Vault on, especially if you have an SSD.
I agree with that. Yeah. I guess, I mean, you know, I set it up for my dad, right, on the new MacBook Pro I told you about last week. And the only problem is if you reboot the machine, it, by default anyway, asks you for the password, for your user account password to decrypt the drive immediately, right? And then it boots and then does whatever you told it to do to auto log in or not, you know, along those lines. And it's fine, except... if I'm working on the machine, he's got to sort of deal with it, which is fine. I mean, as soon as I explained to him why it was, he's like, oh, okay, I get it. But if I'm working on the machine remotely and I go to reboot it, I've got to be very, very careful. There is a way to tell it to auto decrypt on the next reboot, but you know, I can't just like, I have to stop and think about that. Like, oh yeah, I got to do the secret handshake. Otherwise this isn't going to work. So yeah. Yeah. So anyway, all right. Two more questions here. We're going to go to Fred because I would love to hear your advice on this. I feel like this is one of these things that might be of interest to more than just Fred. Fred says, I have about 50 VHS tapes that I would like to transfer from VHS to media files on an external drive. Some of the tapes are not on DVD. I was wondering if Roxio's VHS to DVD converter would be a good tool to use. It appears that it will do this, but the trick then is getting it into iTunes. So Roxio's VHS to DVD converter is essentially taking your movies and inputting them. It comes with a USB dongle to then plug into your VHS player. So it's digitizing the video. And then its default workflow is to then burn it to a DVD and also chunk it up so that it fits properly on a DVD and all of that. But it will also convert it to pretty much anything else you would want, including putting it into iTunes. So I think this software would be perfect for you because it comes with all the stuff you need to sort of slurp from your VHS player. And then you can take it from there. So you can create, you know, movies that are readable by iTunes or QuickTime or anything you want at that point. I think you're going to be fine with this. So, but if anybody else has any thoughts on it, please, you know, send them in. And John, if you've got them now, but you know, happy to hear from it. But
what's VHS?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, he's not alone. I think there's a lot of people.
I think I just read an article that the last company that made VHS devices stopped making them because no one uses them anymore.
Yeah, but you know, you might have, I mean, certainly, you know, I know I have a ton of stuff on VHS that I really should archive off because...
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean, old, you know, like, well, I mean, I mentioned Computer Nerds earlier. We did a bunch of TV commercials for them. It was the first TV advertising I ever did, you know, and It would be cool to have that stuff, you know, just for posterity, you know.
I think my parents still have some stuff on Super 8, I think it is.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, that stuff's not going to last forever. So if you want to save that stuff as, you know, family memories or career memories or whatever it is, it's kind of important. Think about it sooner than later. So that's why I wanted to squeeze that one into the show. And then I think we have time for Chuck. Let's see. I may regret this, but time-wise, I may regret this, but I think we'll be okay. He says, my wife has a new MacBook Air that we purchased this spring. I'm using a two-year-old MacBook Air. Our systems and software are the same. She has a slow response time to her web links using Safari. I thought she was imagining the problem, but after a couple of days of her voicing concern, we set up side by side and clicked on the same sites in unison. We're using Yahoo Japan as she accessed that regularly. The top page loaded in close to the same time as do sites directly via a Google search. But in going to one of the Yahoo News links, her time to open was significantly slower than mine. Mine was already open and her progress bar was still inching along the window. We compared Safari preferences. The only difference was her use of Safari autofill for website logins. We turned that off, no difference. Further, in our matching speed test, we weren't accessing a website that required a sign in the first place. She's also having the same issue with Firefox. We compared network settings, DNS proxies, etc. They are the same. So I instantly thought of DNS, right? And I know you said you tested that. So let's rule out a couple of other things, and then maybe let's look at DNS again. What happens if you both launch the terminal and issue ping space www.apple.com and then press enter? What that's going to do, or should do, is start showing you a line by line, 1 second spaced in between each of them, showing you how long it takes for that computer to send and get a response from www.apple.com. And Apple, that site is set up to do this for you. It's set up to do this. I don't know if they'd set it up for you, but it does allow pings and it will respond to pings. So it's a good one to test. It's going to give you an answer. There's going to be a whole lot of stuff on that line. The last thing, kind of on the rightmost side of that, of each line that comes across, is the amount of time that it took to get that packet all the way round trip. And it's going to be measured in milliseconds. So take a look at that. If, you know, one of them is 20 and one of them is 30, that's not a huge deal, even though, yes, it's 50% difference. It's only 10 milliseconds. But if one of them is 20 and the other is 400, or one is reporting, that it's got it's missing returns and that sort of thing, if one's getting packet loss and the other is not, that indicates that you've got a problem with perhaps the wireless network. Something networking wise is wrong there. Control C will stop that listing, by the way, just so you're not stuck with it forever. So that's the first thing I would test. And I'm going to assume that that's going to be okay, but let's rule that out before we start driving ourselves crazy. Assuming the pings are normal, like I said, I just can't stop thinking about DNS, because that sounds like what you're talking about here is the time it takes to do the lookup can be the problem. Now, proxies, you also mentioned, can get in the way of this. If you have proxies set to be automatic and it's waiting for a response from a proxy server that doesn't exist, that can also slow things down. But since you're seeing this in Safari and Firefox, I don't think it's proxy, because they both deal with that in a different way. You configure Safari's in your network settings. You configure Firefox's proxy in Firefox. It is a separate setting, so it shouldn't be impacted by this. Back to DNS. My thought and the test would be, I know it looks like she's getting the same DNS server that you are, but let's force you, or at least force her, to use a different one, and maybe force you both to use the same just for the purposes of a test. Go into System Preferences, Network, go to whatever device it is, I assume Wi-Fi, go to Advanced and go to DNS, and manually add in a single entry of 8.8.8.8. And then close that window, hit apply, and go try your tests again. That will use Google's DNS of 8.8.8.8 and will certainly rule out or in whether or not this is a DNS issue. And if that doesn't work, oh, I don't know. We'll test the DNS. What do you think, John?
I'm with you. And that, you know, it could be. I actually had this happen one time. I had inadvertently at one point manually set the DNS on one of my machines and not the other. And then I noticed that they were acting different. And I verified the setting. And, you know, the place that you said is the place to go. You go to your network interface, advanced DNS. Well, first, I just went to the TCP IP panel. And I looked and I'm like, oh, wait a second. The entry in DNS is not what I expected. Oh, I know another. There was another time I had another DNS head scratcher, and it was actually because I manually set it on my router, thinking that was a good idea. And then I wanted to manually set it, but I think for whatever reason. No, what I thought I had set manually on the computer was actually set on the router, and it was propagating, because I'm like, how do I get rid of this? I don't want that setting. And it would just keep pushing this, you know, value that I didn't want to the computer until I eventually realized, oh, that's because I told it to do that.
Yeah, you told it.
Let's not do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So reviewing what each of your devices, your computers and your router, have set for DNS is useful as well.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, you could. I mean, I'm with you that it's a network related thing. At first, I was thinking the problem could be, you know, various browsers have ways of flushing the cache or clearing the history or something like that. At first, I thought it was maybe like a cookie or.
Yeah, but or two totally different browsers. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you're talking two different browsers, then yeah.
And especially
goes away.
Especially Firefox versus Safari, like Chrome and Safari both use WebKit. Right. So there's, you know, potentially some core stuff that could be impacted the same. But Firefox is totally self-contained, at least as far as that goes. So, yeah. All right, folks. Well, that's where we're going to wrap it up today. We've told you how to get in touch with us, but there are a few of you I want to thank very specifically. And those are our premium listeners whose questions we answered today. That would be starting back from the beginning of the show. Listener John. JP, listener Jim, Bobby, Alan, Greg, Chris, Dave, and Chuck. So thank you all for being premium listeners of Mac Geek Gab. Thanks to everybody in the chat room who is a premium listener too. I know there are many, many of you there. You folks really, really help us out. And you can sign up for premium at MacGeekGab.com. And of course, if you are a premium listener, then you get to use premium at MacGeekGab.com to email us as well. I also want to thank CacheFly at CacheFly.com for providing all of the bandwidth to get the show from us to you and then our sponsors. This show, of course, sponsored by Bushel at Bushel.com/MGG, where you get a free account for life for three devices. Gazelle at Gazelle.com. Smile at SmileSoftware.com/geek. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com, Barebone Software at barebones.com, and Casper at casper.com/MGG. Thanks so much, everybody. Thank you, John. A fun show. Hey, John, what do you have to say before we sign
off? I got one thing to say. You know what? Dave, no, but you and I almost got in trouble here.
We did?
A friendly reminder. If your certificates are about to expire, renew them so they don't expire, because I almost forgot about ours, Dave, and we almost got caught.
Made up.